Thanks, Brother Josh, and good morning once again, brothers and sisters. We have given out to you a handout, which many of you might already have, on which is a chronology of the book of Jeremiah. And what it deals with is the various incidents in his life, the things happening to he and his friends, along with a history of the various kings and rulers who have a bearing upon the book of Jeremiah. Perhaps the most valuable part of that handout is a suggested order in which the chapters of Jeremiah should be read. If any of you have ever looked at Jeremiah before, you'll know that it is a chronological mess. The chapters are very much out of order. And it is very helpful to go through and actually read the book of Jeremiah in the order that is given on that particular chart. And that's what that handout has attempted to do, as well as to give you a little bit of information about what's going on around the various nations that have an impact upon the book. Well, the story of the Rechabites is a very simple story, brothers and sisters, but it has a very powerful lesson for us to teach, and it's the lesson of keeping good family values. We live in a community today that is very similar to Jeremiah, a community that is beginning to lose sight of the old paths. It has lost the sense of those things that have been tried and proven. Jeremiah was caused to appeal, and I'll just read you Jeremiah 6 and verse 16. It said, "Thus saith Yahweh, stand ye in the way and see, and ask for the old paths, wherein is the good way, and walk therein, and ye shall find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk therein." So in the Rechabites, we have an appeal to uphold family values and to preserve the truth down through the ages. Now, the timing of this incident is fairly easy to pick up. We're told back in verse 1 that it was during the reign of King Jehoiakim. Now, we're not given a specific date as to when in Jehoiakim's reign it was given, but we do know in verse 11 that there was a time when there was the army of the Syrians that came through and marauded the land, and it forced the Rechabites to come within the walls of the city. The Rechabites normally dwelt as strangers in tents, and they weren't normally in the city. But because of the armies of the Syrians, they were forced for protection for them and their families to come inside the walls of the city. And if you make a note against the Second of Kings 24 and verse 2, we'll see that that actually took place during the seventh year of Jehoiakim. It was 3 years after Nebuchadnezzar came into the city. We know that he came in the city during the fourth year of Jehoiakim. So Jeremiah 35 takes place during the seventh year of Jehoiakim. Now, as we mentioned, the book of Jeremiah is very much jumbled up historically. And chapters 34, 35, and 36 are no different. But they have been jumbled up for a very deliberate reason. Chapter 34 actually deals with Zedekiah. And Zedekiah was a man who, as we saw in our exhortation, was a covenant breaker. He broke the covenant that he had made with Nebuchadnezzar. In Jeremiah chapter 34, we have the record of Zedekiah breaking a covenant with the slaves. They let all the slaves go, and he made a covenant with them. And then later on, he takes the slaves back and brings them back into slavery. He had broken the covenant with them. And in Jeremiah 34, the word that keeps coming up over and over again is that word covenant. Zedekiah, above everything else, was a covenant breaker. And in that reference we have on the screen, in 2 Chronicles 36 and verse 13, that was what was particularly displeasing to God about Zedekiah, was that he was a covenant breaker. He was not a man of his word. And he's exactly the opposite to the Rechabites, who followed the word of their father and did what their father commanded them. They weren't people who were duplistic in their service. Now, chapter 36 is about Jehoiakim. Now, Jehoiakim was a proud, materialistic man. If you just look at this chart, we see that Jehoiakim was totally different to his father, Josiah. If you just look at Josiah and flip it, that's Jehoiakim. Josiah was a man who dedicated himself to God in his youth, as we saw. Jehoiakim was a man who rebelled against God in his youth. We saw that Josiah delighted and trembled greatly to hear the word of God being spoken. Jehoiakim burnt the word of God in the fire. You see, he was exactly the opposite to to his father. And in that reference we have there in Jeremiah chapter 22, what God is doing is contrasting Jehoiakim with his father and saying, you are a traitor to your father, Jehoiakim. He says in Jeremiah 22 and verse 15, did not thy father eat and drink and do judgment and justice? See, God keeps bringing Jehoiakim back to his father. You are the opposite of your father, Jehoiakim. He lived a simple life. He did not build himself an enormous palace as you did. Jehoiakim was a man who robbed the people by heavy taxation. Josiah was a man who vindicated the poor. Josiah executed the judgment of the poor and needy. Jehoiakim shed innocent blood. So you can see that he's exactly the opposite to his father, as was Zedekiah. Zedekiah was a covenant breaker. Josiah was not a covenant breaker. And so sandwiched in between, we have chapter 35, which is the record of the Rechabites. And the Rechabites are commended for upholding the values of their father, Jonadab, who gave man-made laws 230 years before Jeremiah 35 was written, and his descendants were still honoring them. And Zedekiah and Jehoiakim were dishonoring to their father. They were the exact opposite. And it's fitting that both Zedekiah and Jehoiakim reigned for 11 years each. They both reigned 11 years. And 11 is the biblical number of failure. They failed to live up to their father's principles. And to condemn them both, God took the Rechabites. Now, it was not just the king that was on the throne at that time and the king who was to come. It was also the people who were to be condemned. If we come back to Jeremiah chapter 2, you see, what God's going to end up with in the story of the Rechabites is to say, well, if the Rechabites can obey their father, then why can't Israel obey me? In Jeremiah chapter 2, we read an astonishing statement about just what Israel had done with the worship of their father. In Jeremiah 2 and verse 9, he says, wherefore I will yet plead with you, saith Yahweh, and with your children's children will I plead. For pass over the isles of Kittim and see, and send unto Kedar. In other words, Kittim was to the utmost west. Kedar was to the east. He says, you go right across from the far west to the far east and see if you've seen any phenomenon like this. Verse 11, hath a nation changed their gods, which are yet no gods, but my people have changed their glory for that which doth not profit. Be astonished, O ye heavens, at this, and be horribly afraid. Be ye very desolate. This is a terrible thing, saith Yahweh, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns, that can hold no water. And so what Israel did was to commit a phenomenon that was unknown in the ancient world. They completely abandoned the worship of Yahweh and set up a totally different religion. That's what verse 11 says. Hath a nation changed their gods, which are yet no gods? For my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. So the people are likewise to be condemned by the Rechabites. The Rechabites honored the principles of their father, Jonadab. The people failed to live up to and failed to honor the laws, the just and the holy laws of their father, Yahweh. And that's why we find the record of the Rechabites in the book of Jeremiah, to show everybody that we can uphold family values. We can maintain the standard of the truth. Well, who were the Rechabites? Well, the story of the Rechabites is fairly well known, but just for those who may not be familiar with them, the Rechabites actually were descended from Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses. Now, Jethro and his family were known as the Kenites. Make a note of Numbers chapter 10, verses 29 to 32. Hobab, who was Zipporah's brother, was offered the hope of Israel. And what Moses said to Hobab was, look, Hobab, we need your help going through the wilderness. You know the wilderness better than we do. You will be eyes unto us. And when you come into the promised land, you can dwell with us and have a place alongside us in the promised land. Now, we're not told of the decision that Hobab made in Numbers chapter 10, except that we do know that in Judges chapter 1 and verse 16, the family of Hobab was now dwelling with Israel. So this is a family that started off all the way back at Sinai and is still existent in the times of Jeremiah. Jael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite, was of the same family. And despite her husband aligning himself with the armies of Sisera, she faithfully put that tent peg through the skull of Sisera, and she did that in the tent. And we'll see the application of that to the Rechabites in a moment. Then some 400 years later, in the days of Saul, Saul issued a charge to the Kenites. And he says, look, if you will separate from the Amalekites, then you will be spared the judgments that were to carry out upon them. And because the Amalekites and the Kenites were both nomadic tribes dwelling in tents, Saul said to them, you must separate from the Amalekites if you want to be saved. Then another 200 years later, and bear in mind, we're coming across some 500, 600 years of history here, and the Kenites and the Rechabites are still here as a distinct part of Israel. A man called Jonadab appears. Now, the linked verse that I'd like you to look at is the First Chronicles, chapter 2, and verse 55. This is the link between the Kenites and the Rechabites. One of those verses that just seems to be tucked away in a chapter full of names. In 1 Chronicles 2 and verse 55, it says, and the families of the scribes which dwelt at Jabez, the Tirathites, the Shimeathites, and the Sukkathites, these are the Kenites that came from Hemath, the father of the house of Rechab. So the family of the Kenites, which Jethro was a member of, and Hobab, all the way back in the very early part of the nation's history, is the same family that we see in Jeremiah 35, known as the Rechabites. From the Kenites came one particular family called the Rechabites. And this family dwelt alongside Israel for hundreds of years. So the same family, known as the Rechabites in Jeremiah's time, was the Kenites in the days of Moses. Now what we want to look at is the pioneer of the house of the Rechabites, and it's a man called Jonadab. I'd like you to come to 2 Kings chapter 9 and 10. Jonadab is the one responsible for instituting the laws that were respected in Jeremiah 35. Now, 2 Kings 9 and 10 is about the destruction that Jehu carried out upon the house of Ahab and Jezebel. Having received his commission from Elisha the prophet, he begins this great purge of the nation. And in 2 Kings chapter 9, Jehu rides forth. Verse 21, And Joram said, make ready, and his chariot was made ready. And Joram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, went out, each in his chariot, and they went out against Jehu, and met him in the portion of Naboth the Jezreelite. And it came to pass, when Joram saw Jehu, that he said, is it peace, Jehu? And he answered, what peace, so long as the whoredoms of thy mother Jezebel and her witchcraft are so many? Verse 24, then Jehu drew a bow with his full strength, and smote Jehoram between his arms. And the arrow went out of his heart, and he sunk down in his chariot. So there was one member of the house of Ahab gone. In verse 25, Jehu said to Bidkar, his captain. The word Bidkar means the assassin. See, Jehu got himself well prepared with cohorts to wipe out the house of Ahab. In verses 27 to 29, we see that Ahaziah is killed. In verses 30 to 37, we know what happened to Jezebel, that they threw over the wall and she was left for the dogs to eat. In chapter 10, in verse 1, we're told that Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. Well, they all got wiped out. Verse 13, the brethren of Ahaziah went up. They all got wiped out. There were 20 and 4 of them, or 2 and 40 men of them. Verse 14, neither left he any of them. So you see, Jehu is going right through the nation like a volcano, wiping out every last vestige of the house of Ahab and Jezebel. And then an incredible thing happened. Verse 15. And when he was departed thence, he lighted on Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, coming to meet him. Now, I want you to notice, brothers and sisters, who was looking for who. Jehu was not looking for any help. But Jehonadab heard of the great purge that Jehu was performing against the house of Ahab and Jezebel, and he said, I want to be in that chariot. And so Jehu recognizes him as somebody who might be on the same side. And he says in verse 15, is thine heart right as my heart is with thine heart? And Jehonadab answered, it is. If it be, give me thine hand. And he gave him his hand and he took him up in the chariot. Now, Jehonadab means willing of Yahweh. And the word Rechab means to ride. So he rode in the chariot of destruction with Jehu. And the word chariot in verse 15, at the end of verse 15, actually comes from the same root as the word Rechab. In verse 16, so they made him ride Rechab in his chariot, which is also derived from the word Rechab. So there's a play on names there. He was willing, and so he made him ride in the chariot of destruction. Now you may know that Rechab is connected with the Hebrew word cherubim. It's from the word Rechab that the word cherub is derived. It means to ride. It means a vehicle in which somebody rides. And so this man was a representative of the way. And he was preserving that way by executing vengeance along with Jehu against the house of Ahab and Jezebel. Well, they went to Samaria in verse 17, and they slew all that remained unto Ahab in Samaria. And then, at the end of the chapter, there's a huge feast that was called to Baal. Jehu is just going through the nation like a volcano, wiping out everybody. And he wants to remove every last particle of the house of Ahab and Jezebel. So he calls this huge feast to Baal. And verse 21, the house of Baal was full from one end to the other. They made them all put their idol worship clothes on. And Jehu went, verse 23, and Jehonadab the son of Rechab went into the house of Baal. And they said, look, we have to make sure that no worshippers of Yahweh have snuck in, but worshippers of Baal only. So the house was absolutely packed from one end to the other with worshippers of Baal. In verse 24, they went in to offer their sacrifices and burnt offerings. Jehu appointed 80 men without and said, if any of the men whom I have brought into your hands escape, he that letteth him go, his life shall be for the life of him. So Jehu said to the men who were to carry out this judgment, if you let any of these guys live, I'll take your life. And so they went in, verse 25, and slew them all with the edge of the sword and turned it into a dung heap. Incredible, the destruction that was carried out by Jehu and by Jehonadab. Now, God was so pleased with Jehu for the work that he had done in executing vengeance on the house of Ahab and Jezebel that God gave him a reward. He would be king, and his descendants also would be kings. In verse 30, and Yahweh said unto Jehu, because thou hast done well in executing that which is right in mine eyes, and hast done unto the house of Ahab, according to all that was in my heart, thy children unto the fourth generation shall sit upon the throne of Israel. So he would be king, and 4 successive generations of his sons would be king. And for 100 years, of the 215 years that the northern kingdom existed, 100 was controlled by the family of Jehu. That was an outstanding reward for his zeal. The tragedy was, brothers and sisters, that when the fighting was over, Jehu failed himself. You know, a very wise brother once said, it is much easier to fight for our principles than it is to live up to them. And that's a great epitome of Jehu. He was excellent at fighting for the principles of the truth. But when the war was over, his own sinful nature was one enemy that he could never defeat. But God nevertheless rewarded Jehu for the work that he had done. And God does notice those, and God does reward those who fight and defend his truth. God did reward the house of Jehu for what they had done. The tragic failure of verse 31 is a lesson to every one of us. That when the fight is over, you see, sometimes we have to stand up for the truth. And men put great emphasis in fighting for the truth, and so we should. I'm all for opposing any deviation from the glorious principles that we uphold. However small it may seem, we have to fight for the truth. But let's remember that the greatest fight that we will ever have is with ourselves, each and every day of our lives. Jehu took no heed, verse 31, to walk in the law of Yahweh with all his heart, for he departed not from the sins of Jeroboam, which made Israel to sin. And it was so sad, brothers and sisters, that Jehu, who had done so much good for Israel, now personally failed. And verse 31 is the reason why Jonadab, who felt so let down at the demise of Jehu, decided to make laws for his family. You see, what they had witnessed for all that time under the reign of Ahab was the ivory palace of Ahab. The sumptuous garments of the house of Baal, the wealth of that kingdom was incredible. Jehu had been nothing but an ordinary soldier before he was given that job. And very likely, the opulence and the wealth that Jehu now inherited as the new king of Israel was not doing him any good. And also very likely, wine had something to do with the downfall of Jehu. For some reason, because of verse 31, Jonadab decided to make laws for his family, that they would live a pilgrim life, that they would live in tents, and that they would drink no wine forever in their generations. You see, verse 31 is the basis of Jeremiah 35, verses 6 and 7. They said, Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, commanded us, saying, you shall drink no wine, you shall not live in palaces, you shall live in tents as strangers. And those two who started off with their hearts together in a mission to destroy Ahab, when Jehu failed, Jonadab decided to make laws for his family. Jonadab was determined that his family would not follow in the way of Jehu and Ahab. Now, the values of Jonadab are interesting. They take on two parts. The first is, you shall drink no wine. Now, wine, as we know, contains alcohol. And alcohol is a foreign chemical to the body. The body has very great difficulty in dealing with alcohol. What alcohol actually does is it attacks the control mechanism in our brains that handles inhibitions. What we know we should do or what we know we shouldn't do. Alcohol attacks and destroys that control mechanism. Noah, after the great triumph of saving his family and all the animals in the ark, disgraced himself through wine. Lot found himself exploited by his daughters through wine. Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus chapter 10 and verse 1 offered strange fire because they were under the influence of wine and ended up being carted off. And as soon as they were carted out, God said to Aaron, you and your sons will drink no wine. Now, why would God suddenly give that law, unless perhaps that wasn't the problem with Nadab and Abihu in the first place, that they weren't clear-headed? And so you see, people lose control. They lose control when they are under the influence of alcohol. What Jehu should have done was to have read the words of Solomon. Let's go to that in Proverbs 31. These words could form a caption over the life of Jehu. Proverbs 31 and verses 5 and 6. Here Solomon is giving a charge to kings. So Jehu was to listen to these words. Verse 4. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes strong drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. Strong drink, he says, is only used, verse 6, for those who are ready to perish. Those who are about to die might find some solace in strong drink, but it's not for kings, says Solomon. It's not for those who need clear judgment. And Solomon, of course, had experimented with wine. He said in the Ecclesiastes, I gave my heart unto wine, but it was only vanity and vexation of spirit. You end up like a man trying to walk on a ship. Like a man who lies down in the midst of the sea, says Proverbs 23. Poor judgment and embarrassing errors will follow. And God said to Aaron and his sons, "You who have the responsibility to teach and to decide in the nation, you shall drink no wine." Why? That you might put difference between holy and unholy. So you have to have that clear perception to make the right judgments. Jonadab also imitated the law of the Nazarite. Those who sought to imitate their high priest and the law that was given in wake of the tragedy of Nadab and Abihu, those who sought to imitate that, they were not even to touch the grapevine or its products. They were to abstain from wine as their high priest was to abstain from wine. And in the New Testament, drunkenness is forbidden. Be not drunk with wine, says the apostle, wherein is excess. You might say to me, well, didn't Paul say to Timothy, take a little wine for your stomach's sake? Well, of course he did. A little wine for medicinal purposes only. And bear in mind, they were traveling preachers. The antiseptic qualities of wine were very useful for those who were traveling to different cultures and eating different foods. And when we read about Jesus and the disciples, they always had wine with food. And that greatly helps with the absorption of the alcohol. No, the Bible doesn't say we can never drink wine. What it says is that we must never get drunk. But abstinence is not a bad policy to consider. It's a very sad trend that I've found in the quarter of the brotherhood that I've come from, that in recent times, drinking is becoming more and more an acceptable practice amongst Christadelphians. I've seen it at some weddings, and I've seen it at private get-togethers that have been arranged. And I don't think it's a good trend. Jonadab, the son of Rechab, would have been most unhappy to see it. We don't need to make it common. We don't need to lead people into temptation unnecessarily through wine. Now, I'm not condemning anybody in here for drinking wine. I'm just saying abstinence is not a bad policy to consider. Just think about these words from Brother Robert Roberts. He was actually talking about this. He was talking about the passage in Romans 14, where Paul says, "I will not eat or drink if I cause my brother to stumble." Brother Roberts says, "It is manifested by the law of Christ that we are under an obligation to consider the bearing of our actions on others. If we're indifferent on this head, we might find ourselves unexpectedly confronted with unknown responsibilities in the day of account. And I've known brethren who have exercised their liberty in this matter of drinking wine and later on have been ashamed of themselves because they found out that they were the cause of stumbling for somebody else." Again, I'm not condemning anybody for taking a drink. All I'm saying is abstinence is not a bad policy to consider. Now, the other thing that Jonadab said was a pilgrim lifestyle. They were to dwell in tents. They were not to sow seed. And that's how they could maintain the faith through all those years, because they had been separate. They weren't to build houses. They weren't to sow seed or to plant vineyards. And by that, they imitated the faith of many past examples. Remember what was said of Abraham in Hebrews 11, verse 9, that he dwelt in tents or tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, being heirs with him of the same promise. They also imitated the example of their great-great-grandmother, Jael. Remember, Jael killed Sisera in the tent. And when Deborah was pronouncing her song and giving blessings upon the various tribes, she said of Jael, "Blessed shalt thou be among women, blessed shalt thou be in the tent." In the tent. So in constructing tents, they would remember the great example of Jael. And the result of that is that they might live long in the land. And of course, we all know where those words echo back to. That's the fifth commandment. Honor thy father and thy mother, that ye may live long in the land which I have given you. And Paul, in quoting that reference from Exodus 20, says in Ephesians 6 in verse 2, that it was the first commandment with promise. As a matter of fact, it's the only commandment with promise. What's different about the fifth commandment? Can anybody tell me? What's different about the fifth commandment?
It's
Well, it's the only commandment that doesn't have a negative in it, a not, a thou shalt not. It's the only positive commandment of the ten. In the other nine commandments, you'll actually find 11 negatives. And 11 is the number of failure. It was God's way of saying, well, that just merely keeping law isn't going to save you. But you will get there by honoring your father and your mother. And that's why it's in the fifth position. What's five the number of? Grace. It's in the fifth position. And you will get there by honoring your father and your mother. And so they had become nomads and they dwelt apart. What is interesting is that we don't find the Rechabites trying to convert everybody else to their standards, but they lived by what their father had commanded. Now, Jeremiah chapter 35 is 230 years after Jonadab, the son of Rechab, had made that law. That's quite a long time. We know in this age just how hard it is to maintain the truth over a few years or over a generation or two. This is 230 years after Jonadab gave that law. How have they gotten along? Well, the Rechabites are still there in Jeremiah 35. They're still keeping their family principles. And they haven't gone down the path that the rest of Israel has gone down. The northern tribes have already been taken into captivity at this stage. And the Rechabites are still living the Abrahamic spirit as strangers and pilgrims. And the only reason they were in the city at this time was because of the marauding bands of Syrians. And they were highly embarrassed. In fact, they were explaining to Jeremiah, look, we're not normally here. And we don't want to be here. It's only because we feel the need for protection at the moment that we have come inside the walls of this city. Now, how surprised would they have been to get a summons from Jeremiah to come down to the temple? The test that they were put under in Jeremiah 35, 2-5, is most fascinating. Let's just read Jeremiah 35, verses 2-5. Let's just paint the scene of what happened. You see, the record is almost tedious in its detail. Verse 2, go unto the house of the Rechabites and speak unto them, and bring them into the house of Yahweh, into one of the chambers, and give them wine to drink. Then I took Jaazaniah, the son of Jeremiah, the son of Habazaniah, and his brethren, and all his sons, and the whole house of the Rechabites. So every single member of this family was brought down to the temple. This wasn't just the leaders or the representatives. The whole family was brought there. And verse 4, I brought them into the house of Yahweh, into the chamber of the sons of Hanan, who seems to be a very good man, a supporter of Jeremiah, a man of God, which was by the chamber of the princes, which was above the chamber of Maaseiah, the son of Shallum, the keeper of the door. Now look at the detail. By the chamber of the princes, which was above the chamber of Maaseiah. To people who had been in tents all their lives, this was an awe-inspiring locality. To be in the temple, right next door to the Sanhedrin, and right above the chambers of the governor of the city, this would have been an awe-inspiring sight. Would they feel comfortable? Would they feel at home? Certainly not. They were totally out of their comfort zone. And that was the point of all that detail. And there was upon them tremendous pressure to conform to what Jeremiah said they do. And verse 5, I set before the sons of the house of Rechab pots full of wine and cups. And I said to them, drink ye wine. So Jeremiah says, well, there you are. I brought you here to have a drink. For those of you who like coloring exercises, and I hope you do, because I do, there are a lot of good ones in this chapter. The words sons and daughters actually appear 18 times, and the word obedience occurs 9 times. You see, that's the theme of the chapter. I set before the sons of the house of Rechab. You see, they were always sons of Jonadab. They weren't ashamed to claim loyalty to their father, and they obeyed his words. And here they are standing around Jeremiah, being watched by all the important men of the city. The Sanhedrin is just right next door. The chamber of the governor is just right next door. And Jeremiah puts the pots of wine down and says, well, there you are. I brought you here to have a drink. it would have perhaps only taken one of them to cave in and to say, well, okay, what's so wrong with that? But none of them did. You see, they supported each other. Every member of the family was here, and not one of them caved in. You see, because they supported each other. Sometimes, brothers and sisters, when we are at school, when we're at college, or the workplace, we will be tempted to do things that we wouldn't otherwise do. And the pressure is put upon us to change our family values. But they didn't. They were prepared to be consistent. In view of everyone else, they were prepared to be consistent to what their father had told them. They say in verse 6, "We will drink no wine, for Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, commanded us, saying, 'Ye shall drink no wine, neither ye nor your sons forever.'" It was a sound policy that Jonadab had created. And they were not ashamed to admit loyalty to their father's principles. "Honor thy father and thy mother, that thou might live long in the land." We say to our young people and to our brothers and sisters, how would you face temptation at school or at work? Would you stand up for the principles of your family? I remember Daniel, when he went into Babylon, he purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's meat. And that was very likely a family policy from his father, Josiah. We need to foresee that there will be times coming, young people especially, when we are going to be tempted to go against what we have been taught by our parents. You know, mom and dad aren't always going to be there to tell you that you shouldn't do what they're about to do. And we need to be prepared to say that this is a well-proven value in our family, and I'm not going to change. And the lesson was driven home to kings, to rulers, and to people in verse 13. "Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, go and tell the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, will ye not receive instruction to hearken unto my words? The words of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, that he commanded his sons, are performed." So you see, the words of Jonadab were performed 230 years later. And the amazing thing is that Jonadab was dead by this time. He could not know or see whether his children were keeping his laws. He could not send prophets to them to encourage them to uphold their family values. Yet Yahweh himself, Israel's father, was not dead. He could see. He could know. He did send prophets. He was alive. And his laws were totally just and totally right. And yet Israel could not honor the God and Father that they served. So God says at the end of verse 13, "Will ye not receive instruction to hearken to my words?" At the end of verse 14, "But ye hearken not unto me." At the end of verse 15, "Nor hearkened unto me." Verse 16, "But this people hath not hearkened unto me." And it's there at the end of verse 17, "But they have not answered." That's the same word, hearkened, as in the previous verses. And the message is so clear. The Rechabites responded to man-made laws that their father thought were good for them. And Israel, whose father was alive, whose laws were totally just and totally right, they were unable to live up to. And the Rechabites were taken as an example to condemn Israel for the fact that they had not upheld their family values. And the promise that God gave to the Rechabites in verse 19 was, verse 18, just for connection, "And Jeremiah said unto the house of the Rechabites, Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, because ye have obeyed the commandment of Jonadab your father, and kept all his precepts, and done unto all that he hath commanded you. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel." We saw that with Ebed-Melech, didn't we? The God of Israel. You see, because these were Gentiles. "Jonadab, the son of Rechab, shall not want a man to stand before me forever." Now, this promise, "shall not want a man to stand before me," it actually relates to the priesthood. You see, they had sought to act like priests. Many of the laws that Jeremiah 35 lists are laws that the priest also were to keep. And they would not want a man to stand before God forever. In other words, they would be priests. And it applies in the eternal sense. But you know, you look through history, And if you read Brother Walker's book on Jeremiah, you'll see that there's a whole list of references that show that the Rechabites survived down through history, when many in Israel did not. Psalm 71 is taken from the Septuagint version, says, a song sung by the sons of Jonadab when they were taken captive. So the Rechabites actually went into captivity with the nation of Israel, and they came back. Because Nehemiah 3 in verse 14 tells us that they returned from captivity and built part of the wall. And what part of the wall did the Rechabites build? They built the Dung Gate. They were prepared to build the humblest part of the wall because they saw it as service to their God. When James the Just was martyred by Herod, Eusebius tells us that there were Rechabites who protested against the murder of James. In the 12th century A.D., Benjamin, who was a historian, remarked in visiting the land that he found a body of Jews called the Rechabites, still keeping the laws of Jonadab. In 1829, Benjamin Wolfe, a noted traveler and archaeologist, found near Mecca a body of people called the Rechabites, claiming to be the sons of Jonadab. And you can check Smith's Bible Dictionary and the Jewish Encyclopedias and find a whole list of references to the Rechabites. And God said, "They shall not want a man to stand before me forever." And they survived when many in Israel did not survive. But what was the chief reason? Well, they were prepared to follow the limited wisdom of Jonadab, their father. And that has a number of implications for us. You see, Jeremiah 35 doesn't make any comment on the validity of Jonadab's policies. God doesn't say, well, that's a very good law, or that's not so good a law. Some of the laws might seem strange to us. Touch no wine, plant no crops. God wasn't concerned with the laws being valid in every generation. What God commended in the Rechabites was the constancy in their generations and the fact that they aimed high spiritually. The fact that they were prepared to set in their families standards and values that would prevent them from going the way of Jehu and the ungodly. And the fact that God noticed that, and the fact that God rewarded that, is a real encouragement to us, brothers and sisters, that we might establish in our ecclesias and in our families high standards to aim at. You know, the Bible is very clear in telling us that there are high standards that we ought to observe. I just want to talk about one of them. Dress. In Numbers 15, verses 37 to 39, and Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, "Speak unto the children of Israel, and bid them that they make fringes of borders of their garments throughout their generations, that ye look upon it and remember all the commandment of Yahweh and do them, and that ye seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you use to go whoring." So the objective in this piece of legislation is that when people looked upon an Israelite, or when the Israelite walked and they saw that border of blue, they might think of godly ways, that their hearts might not go a-whoring, that their hearts might not be distracted from worship. So they were to dress in modest ways and in modest apparel so that godliness might be promoted. And that's why we establish standards today. We aim high spiritually because we want to promote an environment in which godliness can prosper, an environment in which people don't think after the natural tendencies of the heart. And Jonadab had those aims. He wanted to preserve his family from the evils of materialism and strong drink. Now, God never said Jonadab's policies were perfectly right. What God said was he aimed high and his family lived up to it. And God loves that aiming high. You see, it's great value to us that God commended the fact that they tried to lift the standard of their worship. And ecclesial life, brothers and sisters, just can't work. It can't work if everyone just does what's right in their own eyes. The Rechabites found these laws worked for them, and so they kept to it. It didn't make them righteous. Doing things or not doing things doesn't make us righteous. But what it does is it creates a climate where holiness and edification can prosper. And we have to be prepared to make a courageous stand like the Rechabites and to say, these customs have served us well and we will uphold them. Because once we've lost it, once we've lost the standards that we have worked so hard to establish, it is very, very hard to get them back. We learned that principle from Manasseh, didn't we? Once you give way and leave things up to people's conscience and then try and pull it back, it won't work. And any policy, brothers and sisters, that aims at holiness is useful because it's far better to aim high in the truth than to trust the human heart. It's far better to take a cautious, conservative line in our behavior, in our dress, and in our way of life than to trust the human heart. Now, people say, well, look, surely if we all love God and we all understand His grace, then we can just let our conscience take up. Well, it doesn't work like that. It would be wonderful if we were all so in love with God and so much in love with Him that we didn't need any guidelines. Jonadab knew his family needed guidelines. And because the flesh is weak, it's better to err on the side of caution. It's better to be cautious and conservative than to trust the human heart. So we've seen, brothers and sisters, that it's good to have strong and uplifting values and to pass them on to our children. Come back to Psalm 78. Let me just read you the words of Psalm 78, because this was Jonadab's objective, and it must be ours as well, that we might establish in our families and in our ecclesias high standards, that godliness might be promoted. Psalm 78, verse 3, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us, we will not hide them from our children, showing to the generation to come the praises of Yahweh and His strength, and the wonderful works that He hath done. For He established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which He commanded our fathers that they should make known to their children. That's what Jonadab had done. That the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments. And that's precisely what Jonadab had done. We saw how the policies that he implemented were based upon the lives of the patriarchs and the lives of those faithful of old. And God loves those brothers and sisters who aim high in their standards. Let's never think that if we establish standards that we're going to be Pharisees or we're going to be extremists. You know, Brother Roberts, who was a very wise brother, said this, and this is very useful in the matter of aiming high and setting high standards. He says it's unwise to discourage the exuberance of spiritual affections. There is not much danger in the extreme love of the things of the Spirit as there is of coming short. How easy it is to become Laodicean and lukewarm than to rise to the Spirit's glow. There's not much danger in the exuberance of spiritual affections. It's much better to aim high than to become Laodicean and lukewarm, to trust the human heart. And what we need to do is to think with our God, who is a holy God, who tells us in no uncertain terms not to trust this nature that we bear, but to honor those tried and true principles that our fathers have taught us. Brothers and sisters, let us learn to honor the holy and high standards in this book and the wisdom of past generations. Young people, when you begin to set out on life, consult the wisdom and knowledge of your ecclesial elders. Find out what's worked in their lives. And don't think that at 18 or at 21 that you'll know better. Listen very carefully about what's worked and what hasn't worked. And we will be far safer taking a cautious and conservative approach to life than to trust our own instincts. In the day of glory, brothers and sisters, Jonadab, the son of Rechab, will be met by many of his descendants in the kingdom of God, who will thank him. Not because his laws were perfect, but because he gave them some guidelines to live up to, which kept them from going into the way of the ungodly and preserved godly principles for hundreds of years. Jonadab, the son of Rechab, shall not want a man to stand before me forever.